It's my real honor to be able to moderate the next of these panels. The first panel, as we constructed this, was kind of the foundation of PEPFAR. The last one is the future direction of PEPFAR, and this is meant to be kind of how do we get from one place to another place, what lessons have been learned. As we saw in the first panel, it's hard to keep people that are so involved on topic exactly, and the first panel got into areas that certainly are appropriate for our panel and appropriate for the next panel. But I don't think we're going to kind of run out of opinions or run out of challenging aspects of this to take on. So we'll get into this. Joining me in this panel are Waf Al-Sadr from Colombia, Alex Muganzi from Uganda, and Jeff Stringer, formerly from Alabama, now from North Carolina, from the University of North Carolina. WAFA has obviously had extensive experience through her work in a number of countries through ICAP. Jeff has been working for a long time in Zambia and has had a chance to see PEPFAR evolve there. And Alex is from the IDI, Infectious Disease Institute in Kampala, but is also the Africa representative for the International AIDS Society. So people well able to comment on the challenges that we're going to be talking about. The PEPFAR, as we all know, like the AIDS epidemic, is a very big and very complex structure. And there's no question that that it has evolved over time. It's been written into the language of PEPFAR that it has changed. And so what we want to talk about in this panel are how did that evolution happen? What lessons were learned? And we structured it as with quotes around it, good lessons and bad lessons. I think they're probably all good as long as the response was appropriate. But what was tried that really didn't work? We'd like to get into that to some degree, and how then were decisions made to respond to that recognition and improve the program, and what was tried that worked really, really well that resulted again in further improvements in the overall program. So as with the last panel, we're going to try to encourage a good dialogue among the panelists. We'll try to save enough time for a few questions from the audience. But I'd like to start, and I'll ask each of the panelists to talk about that. What, as PEPFAR was launched, and it was really focused on scale-up of antiretroviral therapy, and especially with a lot of direction from the United States, as it's evolved, it's obviously focused much more on sustainability, on the roles of the local governments in managing the program and making it truly sustainable. And how did that happen? And maybe I'll ask WAFA to start with that question and see where we go.
Okay. Well, first of all, thank you very much. And it's really a pleasure to be here and to be involved in the launch of this very important supplement.
It's on, but maybe it's pointing away from you. Maybe on your other side, on your other panel. I hate to sort of volunteer here. You're on your own, Wafa. I could help. Yeah, we're all family.
Paul, I've known you for many, many years.
Let's see if this works.
Thank you. Is this better?
Well, let's try it.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to be here and to be part of this supplement that I believe is long overdue, by the way, and we can get into why I believe the supplement is long overdue. I do think that there are, in reflecting back on PEPFAR and from the beginning, and I've been fortunate enough to be involved from the very beginning, is there are some key aspects of PEPFAR that are very unique, and that are also can help inform us as to how to go forward in the next span and how to go forward with the next evolution of this program. Some of the aspects that I think are very unique that have made it such a successful program, I think one of them is from the very beginning, PEPFAR offered a lot of space for innovation. And I think that's very unique for such a large program, and it enabled a lot of learning to happen on the ground and enabled teams on the ground from the countries themselves to innovate. And I think what's always struck me is whenever I go visit programs, whether it's programs that ICAP supports or any other programs, is you see truly in action how healthcare workers and policymakers in the countries themselves are innovating and problem solving, and how that problem solving is informing the programs and leading to their success, continued success. And I think it's this nurturing of innovation that's continued the freshness of this program and the ability to grow and succeed. And I think that's a very precious gift that I believe is very valuable for the future, as well as very valuable for other development assistance programs. I also think another aspect of PEPFAR that's been very interesting is that from day one, there were very clear targets. There were very clear goals that were articulated. And I think that was responsive to a huge need, but I think was also created a rallying point, created very clear objectives that people on the ground themselves cared about and aimed towards achieving. And I think that was, in a way, was very helpful in mobilizing partnerships and mobilizing the path forward. Another aspect that I think is really very interesting about PEPFAR is how fast science was translated into action. Usually, development programs, they're more or less are rather, should I use the word stayed, they're kind of set in stone almost. And maybe this is the characteristic of the HIV itself and the science of HIV and the innovations and the discoveries that happen with HIV is they happen all the time. They're energizing. But what's really most interesting is that how often these were taken to scale, how often teams and countries were receptive, open to incorporating new findings, new directions, new approaches right into programming and actually taking them to scale at a national level. And that's also a very, I believe, is a very unique characteristic of the program that has made it quite successful. I think there have been, if I think of the things that, in reflecting back, maybe could have been done better, mm-hmm. which is the question you asked me, is I do think there was an erroneous perception that I felt prevailing sometimes, that this was somehow a program run from Washington, or that this was a program that was run by the United States, or that the success of the program, there was somehow the perception that it wasn't owned by the countries. And I think that's an erroneous perception, that we could have really fought better and done better in trying to counter. Because I believe from day one, if it weren't for the sense of ownership on the ground, ownership by the healthcare workers at the facilities, ownership by the ministries, ownership by the National AIDS Control Program, if it weren't for that sense of ownership, I don't think it would have succeeded. I don't think any of the achievements would have been achieved without that sense of ownership that has been there all along. But unfortunately, there was a misperception that didn't exist. So I think in thinking back, I do believe that could have been countered much more proactively early on. And then I think lastly, I feel, like I said, is that the supplement in many ways is overdue. The cataloging together of the successes is really pretty impressive. And having worked on the supplement with many of you in this room, it's remarkable. The innovations, the partnerships, the breadth and depth of the programming, from HIV testing to community partnerships to treatment to pediatric HIV to prevention of other transmission. It's just such a vast array of success, and it's heartening to see it all pulled together in a supplement like this, but I feel like it's overdue, this is something that we could have celebrated and shown to the world and shared with the world earlier, but I'm glad it's here now, and I'm glad it's at this opportune moment at the beginning of this very important conference.
And I'll add that while we're here mostly focused around the supplement that we just put together, there's another supplement for health affairs, this edition also addressing the history, the lessons from PEPFAR. Very complimentary, and WAFA and some of the others are also featured in that supplement as well. Alex, the same question to you. As PEPFAR started and moved from where it started to where it is now, what were, in your experience in Uganda, some of the early lessons that changed how things are now being run?
Thank you, Paul. I think what Tony said in the last session, that PEPFAR is probably the best thing that has happened to Africa in terms of healthcare, still stands. I practiced as a clinician in the early 2000s before PEPFAR came, and I recall lines of patients sitting in front of me, and all you are telling them is, go buy drugs if you can. And those drugs could not be afforded by even 1% of the people in the clinics. And then all you are left with as a clinician was to choose who you give drugs to, the little drugs that are available through studies or through donation programs, and who you let die. And you know, it's very stressful for clinicians, it's very stressful for the people in the clinic to choose who gets drugs and who doesn't get drugs. Where if, as clinicians, it became so stressful for us to act God and decide who goes to die with a CDF of 100 and who you give drugs because they have CDF of 20. And in terms of treatment outcome, the outcome is not that different. So PEPFAR came in at a point where it revolutionized the era of HIV/AIDS treatment. And looking back 8 years ago, the clinics that we ran, and now the clinics that we run, where you have the drugs you need, versus the time when drugs were almost not available, makes PEPFAR the best thing that has happened to us that have been in the HIV world. But it also brings out the fact that PEPFAR got out of the way the misconceptions that were there. You know, that Africans could not manage to take drugs that needed to be taken by the hour, drugs that needed to be stored under special conditions, drugs that required, you know, a routine of sorts. And we remember stories of people saying Africans cannot be 100% adherent. But we've read stories of where adherence rates from Africa are part of the best adherence rates. And so that opportunity given by PEPFAR to have drugs accessed by people that needed them, to try it out, and the realization by the people that it could happen, and for people to live for much longer than they would have lived, I think is a credit that goes to PEPFAR. But also over the years, PEPFAR has also brought the notion and the increasing role of civil society. Clearly, before PEPFAR, drugs were available in bigger units, at least in my country. And over the years, you know, civil society organizations like TASO in Uganda have received drugs and taken drugs closer to the communities where people live, which has had a huge impact, you know, on distances traveled by people in terms of accessibility and in terms of outcome. So clearly, PEPFAR has also brought the realization that partnerships can make us get better results. Before, I remember in our clinic at the IDI before PEPFAR, the few drugs we had were from the Global Fund through a MAP program. And before then, it looked like that was all. Our governments could not afford to invest in those drugs. But the partnerships between PEPFAR, between the Global Fund, between the different players have made it real. And everyone realizes that once we pull together, we can put together a bigger impact for the people who need it. So lots of credit goes to PEPFAR, and we continue. I think if you visited one of our clinics, the messages are coming through even from the groups of people that are living with HIV/AIDS. They might not know what PEPFAR is in full, but as someone said before here, they know that PEPFAR is the savior. And it comes through, a few years back, there was lots of uncertainties on whether PEPFAR 2 would come through. And those uncertainties were read through our clinics, where our lines of patients are every day.
Great, wonderful, thank you. Jeff, you were in Zambia when PEPFAR first started. You're still there. Tell us how that again, the lessons from the early days to what you're doing now.
So I moved to Zambia in 2001, and actually just 3 weeks ago have moved back to the United States, so I'm not Zambian.
But you're going back next week.
But I'm going back next week, yeah. It was a very exciting time to be in Zambia in late 2003, early 2004, when PEPFAR first started. There was, prior to that, a glimmer of hope about how we would treat patients and prevent HIV through other initiatives like the one that WAFA was involved in, the so-called MTCT Plus initiative or the Call to Action PMTCT initiative from the Glaser Foundation. But these were smaller pilot type of programs just to show that it might be possible. And if you looked on a population basis, I remember walking into the university hospital. I'm an obstetrician, but going into the medical wards and just seeing the sea of people lying in that hospital, two in a bed, beds on the floor, unbelievably sick people, and thinking, and I think this was a pervasive belief at the time, well, while we may be able to deliver some drugs to some of these people, how are we possibly going to change this on a population level? And so I think that the first thing that we learned from PEPFAR, because of the hugely ambitious targets that were set before us, is that this big thing really is possible. And we were given treatment targets that seemed absolutely impossible when we first started. You remember those days, don't you?
Yes, Wolf? I sure do.
In fact, I remember being just asked if we could get 1,000 patients on treatment in 3 months by our project officer, and it seemed impossible to me. Because there was a prevailing belief that the patients wouldn't come, there's too much stigma associated with HIV, and they wouldn't come to the clinics, or if they did come, the care was too complicated to deliver in primary health facilities, or the laboratory monitoring that was necessary is too arduous. Patients wouldn't be able to take their medicines and so forth. And all of those preconceptions were just blown away within about 2 weeks once the drugs and the funding showed up, and it was amazing.
I remember at the IDI, it opened its doors and suddenly there were 10,000 patients.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so you know, and we had the exact same sort of experience in Zambia, and I know WAFA in the various countries that she was working in. So that to me, just the paradigm shift of what is possible was a really important early lesson, I think.
There's been a lot of talk and some real criticism directed at PEPFAR, charging that with all of this money coming in and with all of it focused on HIV, more or less, that other healthcare priorities might be crowded out, might be outcompeted by PEPFAR, that healthcare workers that otherwise would be working in some other aspect of health are drawn to this because of the resources. Is that a fair criticism? Are there cases where it has crowded out other healthcare, or areas where it might have helped other?
Well, I think you're right. That's been a criticism, particularly over the past 4 or 5 years, is that there's a drawing of the healthcare workers away, resources away, that there'll be underutilization of other services. On the other hand, some others have argued, there are people on both sides of these arguments have argued that, wait a minute, the investments from PEPFAR are not just helping people living with HIV, but also are helping many others. And I do believe that a couple of things are important to keep in mind. I think another area that has been underappreciated is the investment by PEPFAR in health system strengthening. And that's most evident in terms of facilities enhancement, infrastructure building, laboratory enhancements. I mean, building of incredibly well-run laboratories that support everybody, not just the people living with HIV. The training of healthcare workers, the mentorship, the enhancements of maternal child health, of maternities, and so on. So this investment in the healthcare system itself, and particularly in some of the poorest countries has been underappreciated, and that's been a big part of the PEPFAR investment over the years. And that's very evident, I think, to anybody who works in these countries who, I can vividly remember clinics that were unbelievable, almost abandoned buildings that you go now and you see people treated with dignity, or you go to a laboratory that really looked like maybe the, an abandoned building, and it now looks like a wonderful laboratory, and many, many other examples. But more importantly, I think people have been looking for evidence. They've been looking for data to support this one way or the other. And we actually were fortunate. We just had a paper that was in the Health Affairs supplement that Paul mentioned, where we looked at, and Margaret Crook from Columbia looked at the, tried to make an association between the expansion of HIV programs, the expansion of ART, and the impact on deliveries by non-HIV infected pregnant women. And actually what she demonstrated is with the expansion of HIV programming, there was an increase in deliveries by non-HIV infected women. So it was a very concrete evidence of actually a solid spillover effect in with an outcome that's very important, an outcome that we know is very critical for maternal health and to decrease maternal mortality. So I think there's a need for collection of similar data, for actually trying to document with data what are the spillover effects of PEPFAR, but also what are the side benefits and risks that may be associated also with the expansion of HIV programming. And it's heartening to see now more of the, we've been harping on this concept of bridging the divide between people who live HIV and people who do other kinds of work or do health systems work versus HIV work. And we've been trying over the years to bring those groups together so we can actually look at the data and try to learn from actual data what has been the impact. And more importantly, I think, is to look forward and to design studies that to try to actually see how we can, programs can be implemented where you can demonstrate the impact on other health threats in many of the countries where PEPFAR works. So encouraging data. Yeah. But still we need more data. But the investment in health system, I believe, is a very durable investment that is lasting and hopefully will enable the countries themselves to build on this foundation and to be able to address the threats of tuberculosis, malaria, non-communicable diseases, and many, many other threats.
Any experience with this in your situation where PEPFAR has on the one hand, crowded out, out-competed for other health conditions?
Yeah. Clearly the criticism has come through.
Yeah.
But the reality on the ground is that I think whatever criticism comes through, the health system strengthening approaches that PEPFAR has supported have had positive ripple effects that that are useful across the clinics. For example, in some of the districts we work in Uganda, the laboratory strengthening activities that have happened, the pharmacy systems that have happened, have supported all the facilities that are being sought for at the healthcare facilities. For some of the rural health facilities at level 3 or level 4, which are the lower ones, they are getting opportunities to do a complete blood count for the first time in so many years. And that complete blood count or hemoglobin estimation is not only for HIV patients. It's also for, you know, antenatal patients. It's also for all sorts of patients that need them who are not necessarily HIV positive. The health system strengthening efforts have also helped to improve systems. For example, in pharmaceutical ordering, we found that there were lots of issues with ordering drugs across these facilities. And then as you reorganize, as you put in place systems, the systems available do not only order for HIV medicines, they order for all the medicines that are needed across the facilities. So clearly, the health system strengthening interventions have had positive effects across the facility, across the health facility, and not just HIV. Attitudes have changed, staff attitudes, staff and patient attitudes. In most of our rural facilities, patients know when drugs are available at a facility. They know when they should go to a facility, and they know when they should not go to a facility. And as ordering processes improve, patients know that drugs will be available at this time of the month when they are expected to arrive, which wasn't the case. So patients now have reason to come to a facility because they know these systems that have happened around the HIV clinics have also improved services across the other facilities. So clearly, it's a positive effect, but as Wafa said, we need more data to support that beyond the observations that we are making.
So one of the, obviously one of the huge expenses in PEPFAR is the are the drugs themselves, and I think PEPFAR has learned a lot about the supply chain of drugs and the efforts to control the cost of drugs. Jeff, do you want to comment on what you've seen over the duration of PEPFAR in terms of the drug supply and the cost of drugs?
Well, in Zambia, the U.S. government has made a huge investment in supply chain management and has with great success. And we've had, it was a perennial fear when we first started the ART program that we were going to have stockouts and this would be harmful to the patients. And we've had very few, if any, we haven't had any substantial stockouts since we started in 2004. And the small things that happen are sort of fixable with just a little bit of quick on your feet reactions. And so I think that, again, coming back to the theme that it's made us rethink what's possible, the norm before this was that, like Alex says, the patients would know that there's a likelihood that the drugs or the supplies that they might need at their facility wouldn't be there, so sort of why bother? And we have seen over the course of this investment by the U.S. and others into PEPFAR, the attitudes of both the patients and the providers on the ground gradually increase sort of in concert with each other, where now patients show up to the clinic and they expect to be seen on time and to get a diagnosis and to get the right treatment. And the providers are heartened by the fact that they are going to be able to do that for their patients. And so this sort of circling back to the original question about how is PEPFAR sort of stealing from other services, mm-hmm. that is a rising tide lifts all ships kind of argument, I think, for the overall investment, because to the extent that we improve the general clinical care that's being given in some of these facilities, it brings more patients and gives us better outcomes, I think.
Wafa, your program operates in a number of countries, and another concern that I've heard expressed is that PEPFAR, the resources, might attract healthcare workers from adjacent countries that aren't getting this support. I'm wondering what's your experience been with that, and almost the flip side, is there any evidence that PEPFAR has helped retain healthcare workers, trained healthcare workers in Africa because of the support?
Again, I do think we need more concrete data, but clearly the morale issue that I think you both mentioned in terms of healthcare workers and their pride in what they're doing, their own survival, their own ability to contribute to their community, is evident. And I have to think that has had an impact in retaining people working where they are working, rather than fleeing from an environment that was demoralizing, where they felt neglected and not cared for and forgotten. So I think there are these subtle changes that are so evident on the ground that would suggest that just the change in morale and a better working environment, that better appreciation of your value, I believe must have had an impact. And unfortunately, I don't think we have enough data to look at this question, but because I think there's a paucity of data on sort of the workforce overall at a country level to be able to answer that question, but that's very palpable. I think the other area that's been evident over the past several years, also the investments of PEPFAR in trying to also increase the numbers of the pre-service training, increase the numbers of the investments in medical education, the nursing, the NEPI program, and the NEPI programs, nursing education initiative and medical education initiatives are also very important as another new initiative by PEPFAR to try to increase the pipeline. Right. So while there's been a lot of in-service training and so on and motivation, there's also in the need to increase the pipeline, just increase the numbers, recognizing that there's also an enormous brain drain. And the countries themselves are taking enormous initiative with, of course, the task-shifting efforts of trying to sort of decompress the amount of work that different cadres mm-hmm. are doing, trying to right-size what people are doing and appropriately give tasks to appropriate cadres is also very helpful. So I do think there are a lot of initiatives that are trying to increase the workforce, sustain the workforce, diversify the workforce to be able to tackle HIV and hopefully to tackle also the many other health threats. There are very serious health threats within the same communities.
We only have a few minutes left, and we really want to get to the audience with questions. But seeing Julio Montaner in the front row, I can't help but take us in a direction I'm sure will interfere with Tom's panel next, which is, and at this meeting, the focus is clearly going to be on treatment as prevention. And as antiretroviral therapy has shifted dramatically from all about treatment to now lots about prevention, how does that affect PEPFAR? How do you expect that it will affect your own programs? And I'll maybe start again with David.
Alex.
I have a son named David. I don't actually. His name is Alex. Alex.
Right. I think at this point we are well positioned to take on whatever innovations come up, whatever implementation science has come up. And like we said before, PEPFAR has already created the platform for that. And increasingly, for example, in Uganda, the program I work with manages several CDC-funded grants. And over the past months, we've been tasked in making sure that we implement prevention of mother-to-child transmission of HIV programs to ensure that everyone who needs, every mother who needs those drugs gets them. And I see in the next coming months or years, we are going to be tasked at making sure that everyone gets treatment. We already tasked with making sure that everyone with a CD4 count below 350 and below gets the drugs that they require. And PEPFAR through CDC is committed to making that happen. And so I think we are now moving to the implementation bit, implementing what Julio Montaner's science right. and the rest of the literature available has proven works. And I think PEPFAR is still committed to supporting that, working with the national establishments.
Jeff, are you ready to shift to treating your entire population with antiretroviral drugs if this is right?
Well, I'm scared by that, I have to say. In the same way, I think I was scared when PEPFAR first came in and I saw this sort of unimaginably huge sea of people that needed to be treated. I think it's the right thing to do. I think that we have to build the political will and make the scientific case that it needs to be done. But I would be lying to sit here and tell you that I think that it's going to be easy, because I don't think it's going to be easy. We face when you're measuring the effectiveness of treatment services, it's kind of easy to do. Just count how many people are on ART, and it's a big number, and everyone feels good. If you drill down and look at individual patients longitudinally, there are all sorts of issues that we're facing, and the number one thing that we face in Zambia is loss to follow-up. So you enroll patients, you get them dispositioned, started on treatment, and then over time, presumably as they begin to get healthier and feel better, they drop out. And we don't really know where they go. Some of them we do and some we don't. And so I am afraid that as we ratchet up the CD4 threshold for treatment and we get patients who are increasingly healthier and don't see the immediate health need for treatment, that if we don't bring the same kind of laser focus on retention that we give to the medical care of these patients, then we're going to have a problem. So I think it's the right thing to do. I'm on board with it, but I do think that it's going to bring a new set of operational challenges around delivering the services.
But I guess it could be argued that if we don't do it, we won't be able to convince the 500 and however many people down the street that they should stay involved in this. Wafa, your comments.
Yeah, it's interesting. I just ran over from another meeting down the street on HIV and health systems.
It's that kind of week.
Right? This is just the beginning of
Yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And where we had a panel of ministers of health and leaders of national AIDS control programs, all of them from sub-Saharan Africa. And it was quite interesting. I think we need to listen to what they're telling us also. And the countries are not uniform. They all have their own trajectories. They've reached certain levels of coverage now. They're trying to help identify what is the immediate priority, what's the next priority. And they are struggling with resource issues, resources for the next 20 years, they were saying. They're saying they feel that to commit to something, they have to make sure that they have the resources for it for 20 years. They're being told by their leaders within the countries that they need to make sure that if they start something like this, it will be the resources will be available for 20 years. The countries are also at different stages of implementation of the programs and they're setting right now at this moment in time, they're taking the scientific evidence and trying to look at the resources available to them, how they're doing, where they want to be, and trying to come up with their own paths towards getting greater coverage. So I think they're working through this challenge, and it will be interesting to also hear during this big conference their thoughts and their needs as well, and for us to be trying to do what I think was mentioned at the last panel, which is to really try to make the arguments for the need for more resources if we are to be able to scale up further.
Thank you. We have only a few minutes left, but I'd like to give the audience a chance. As we did last time, why don't we take a couple, three or four questions, and we'll try to microphone starting in the front, maybe because I called him out here already. So, so we'll pass the microphone around to a few people, then we won't respond right away.
But. I was intending not to make a comment, but you just did it for me. And I'd like to answer your question, Paul, by saying that I think treatment as prevention is the best thing that could ever possibly happen to PEPFAR and the antiretroviral therapy initiative all over the world, because it's truly the promise to deliver on the bending the curves and ultimately ending the epidemic. And I agree with all of you. The challenges are huge, but no different from what they were when the PEPFAR program started. And we need to be asking ourselves the question, how are we going to do it? And if this is happening, so I'm not worried about it, but with PEPFAR and other initiatives focusing on a few places where we can actually demonstrate that this can be done and that we can really turn the epidemic around, that will give the necessary resources for this to happen. The enthusiasm is going to be there, and I think the Washington Conference is going to be nothing but the catalyst for this to happen.
Pat. Pass the microphone. David, I'll come to you later. You are David.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Mindy Reiser. I evaluated health programs in Central Asia and the Caucasus. And I'm wondering if you people can talk a little bit about AIDS education and how the school systems, how community organizations have talked to people and tried to give them a sense of what not to do so that they don't get AIDS.
Great, thank you. Let's give the microphone to David, and maybe David and Lori, and maybe that's it.
Right.
Okay. One.
Okay. Paul, I just want to talk about this issue about that PEPFAR or HIV programs are crowding out other services. You know, it's not very long ago that papers appeared in, some years ago, papers appeared from West Africa and East Africa, actually demonstrating that actually mortality, that is the pre-ARV, mortality of other diseases actually increased because the bed occupants of HIV-related diseases was so high that in order to be a non-HIV to get in, you had actually to be very, very sick. So that actually it increased mortality. With ARVs and more less occupant of HIV-related, you have to discount that there's more space for other diseases. But otherwise, you would go in clinics or hospitals, they were all HIV. You couldn't, if you came in with typhoid or other illnesses, it was very difficult to get unless you were very, very sick. So I think this has been a huge impact with the introduction of ARV on job occupancy for HIV-related diseases.
Great, thank you. I think Laurie Garrett first, yes? And then we'll quickly try to bring this to a close.
Hi, thanks for the history, folks. Jeff, to your comment about expanding to all HIV patients getting into treatment, I wonder, when you look at the data that we're going to be deluged with in the poster sessions regarding kidney failure rates of 70% in Kenya, 65% osteoporosis findings in Nigeria, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, where do we draw the line between HIV care and general medicine, and where is general medicine status in Zambia, fill in the blanks, other countries?
Great, and may the last question, I think, here in front, yes. And then we'll quickly discuss.
I would like to hear from each of you what a laser-like focus on retention would look like from your perspective.
Great, great. Okay. So the issues, I think, we heard some good statements. The questions were, what about AIDS education in the school system? And I think this one was the only other real question, right? Good.
What about Lori?
Oh, Lori. Sorry. Okay. We'll come to the reception. Alex, you want to start with comments, especially on well, each
education?
Of the three?
Yeah, I think a number of them were not questions.
Yeah, so I think the questions are AIDS. Maybe we can kind of divide this up, but AIDS in AIDS education in the school system.
Yeah, and in the formal setting. So the education system, there is a little bit of HIV/AIDS education in the curriculum, mainly at the lower schools, but we've had controversies within our country about what should be there and what should not be there. And I'm not powered enough to answer that.
Okay.
But for the community bits, the people living with HIV/AIDS in Uganda remain some of the biggest education agents and majorly the change agents. They go in the community, sensitizing communities about HIV. They give testimonies about where they were at the point of death, what drugs, the impact the drugs have made for them, and you know, writing support for those that should be coming through. They're also majorly used when we are mobilizing communities for HIV counseling and testing. So these persons living with HIV/AIDS in the community have been seen as the major agents for education, but majorly through testimonies. And they are well listened to because the communities have seen them at the point that they're about to die, and they have seen them when they are back to life in what has been called the Lazarus effect.
Mm-hmm. Jeff, I think Laurie's comment was specifically about Zambia. You want to comment?
So I think that the there's no line between general medical care and care of HIV infection. I think that's one of the great wins of PEPFAR, is that when you train clinicians in how to give out how to provide ART, it's a general medical training, especially when you put that in the context of the sort of mentorship that's going on and the general improvement of care. So that's part of the way that the rising tide lifts all boats, actually, is that the clinicians who are benefiting from the training and the additional human resources that are being brought into the clinics and so forth, they benefit everyone. And in fact, if you go into the field, a lot of time it's there's not even a physical distinction between the ART clinic and the general medical OPD, because it's probably one person doing it all in the same room. So you know, I think that in larger facilities that have the enough patients and enough staffing to have separate ART services versus OPD, various groups are working on how to better integrate those and to improve efficiencies and so forth. But I think in general, that's sort of a false distinction. And then there was a question about just one.
Let me actually turn that one to Wafa. We're really out of time, and maybe I'll just ask that the treatment cascade, and we're going to be hearing a lot about that at this meeting. Maybe just address the specific issue of retention and care.
Right,
and that'll be our last.
Yeah, well, that could take many hours. Yeah.
We have a week.
Yes, we have a week, but it's something close to my heart, and it really depends on where in the cascade. So I think it's at every step of the cascade there is loss, and we have to figure out, and the interventions, the focus on what interventions to do for which part of the cascade varies substantially. We're losing a lot of people from testing to just introduction to care, and there are innovations now that I think are the way to go of point of care CD4 testing, so you get an HIV positive test, you get your CD4 immediately. Reminders, sending reminders, utilization of peer workers have been all thought of as ways of trying to link people from testing to HIV care. Then there's a huge issue in the cascade, loss in the cascade of people who are not eligible for ART, which I think is a great tragedy. Almost the worst thing that could happen to you is to be diagnosed with HIV earlier and you're not eligible for ART. If you're eligible for ART, you're going to be sort of slotted into a path that where you're going to get a lot of attention and you're going to get more resources for follow-up and you're going to get ART and do well. Unfortunately, people who are not eligible for ART, they're lost. And that's the group where we don't know. Many of them probably die, never come back. And I feel that that's the group where we need to focus on with a lot more diligence and use some innovations, making their follow-up attractive, giving them a package that's definable, that's something they come back for, trying to think of programs.
And something that might be addressed as we scale up treatment to include.
Exactly, that's going to be the same issue. And then the other is where should these people be seen? I mean, if you've ever worked in sub-Saharan Africa or Central Asia, the clinics are overcrowded. There are huge numbers of people, and can we double and triple the number of people to come for follow-up? And I do believe there's a need for innovation of thinking of different models of community care for people who are not yet eligible for ART, where they're cared for by peer workers and a nurse. Or that's how I think we should really think of new, completely new models of how we're going to tackle this, the losses in the cascade, particularly for people who are not yet eligible for ART, where a huge proportion of them are gone. And that's a great tragedy.
Good place to end. We'll close this. I'm going to be very interested during the conference in seeing King Holmes here as well, that the large group of investigators that have spent a long time thinking about behavior and behavioral change and start trying to apply that to some of these challenging issues of retention and in the cascade will be, I think, an interesting thing to watch for this conference. But I want to thank the panelists. Good discussion. Thank you.